Parsha at Mikakes deals with the rise of power of Yosef HaTzadik, being led out of Egypt by interpreting Pharaoh's dreams, and his relationship with his brothers who come down to get food, how he acts as a stranger to them, accusing them of spies, and really allowing the dreams to come into fruition of all the brothers bowing down to him. And the Parsha ends really on a climactic note of accusing Binyamin of stealing the gaviyah, of stealing the goblet, and all the brothers really show a full element of tshuva, of repentance, by saying, "We will all be slaves to your master." They show mutual responsibility, one brother for another. However, it's the beginning of the parasha I'd like to deal with this particular year, and that is the dreams of Paro, which the parasha begins with. If we take a look at the beginning of the parasha, we note that it happened at the end of 2 years to the day, and the rabbis explained that 2 years extra that Yosef HaTzadik had to be in jail by putting his faith in the minister, the Sar HaMashkim, instead of in God. The Paro was dreaming that, behold, he was standing over the river, when behold, out of the river there emerged 7 cows of beautiful appearance and robust flesh, and they were grazing in the marshland. Then behold, 7 other cows emerged after them out of the river, of ugly appearance and gaunt flesh, and they stood next to the cows on the bank of the river. The cows of ugly appearance and gaunt flesh ate the 7 cows of beautiful appearance and robust, and Paro awoke. He fell asleep and dreamt a second time, and behold, 7 ears of grain were sprouting on a single stalk, healthy and good. And behold, 7 ears, thin and scorched by the east wind, were growing after them. And the 7 ears swallowed up the 7 healthy and full ears. And Paro awoke, and behold, it had been a dream. But in the morning, his spirit was agitated, and he summoned for all of his advisors and wise men. And Paro relayed his dream to them, but none could interpret them for Paro. And the story goes on to explain how the Sar HaMashkim at that point realizes, he said, that Chata'ai ani maskir hayom, I remember my sin today. There was this Nari Ivri, this Jewish boy, who was able to correctly interpret the dreams when we were in prison 2 years ago. They bring Yosef HaTzadik in front of Paro. Yosef HaTzadik clearly says, it's not I who interprets dreams, it's rather Kodesh Baruch Hu. He interprets the dreams as being that there will be 7 years of famine, 7 years of plenty, and after that 7 years of famine. And the famine is going to be so intense that you're not even going to remember the 7 years of plenty. At that point he says to Paro in verse 33, "Now let Paro seek out a discerning and wise man, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Paro proceed and let him appoint overseers on the land, and he shall prepare the land of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. Let them gather all the food of those approaching good years. Let them amass fine grain under Paro's authority for food in the cities and safeguard it. The food will be reserved for the land against the 7 years of famine, which will befall the land of Egypt, so the land will not perish in the famine." Seems to be a very nice story. It's the story of Paro's dream, and how Yosef HaTzadik interprets the dream, and this is the means that he rises to power. Or as the Brisker Rav notes, the basic yesod we spoke about a while ago, is that Paro had to dream in order for Yosef to leave. It was time for Yosef to leave, so now, because Yosef had to leave, so then Paro had to have this dream. It wasn't Paro's dream that let Yosef out. Yosef had to go out, and therefore Paro had a dream. But the question I'd like to deal with is a very basic question. It's a question which is really a question where one can ask on any story in Chumash. The question is Siva Shalom. He says, "V'yesh lamar inyan chalamot Paro al derech avodah." One has to understand this story as really a lesson for us in terms of a relationship with God. Sharei tarak tosha ein ba siparei derim ba'alma. We know that the Torah just doesn't tell the story. It's not a storybook, the Torah. As we learn from the Magid of Koshnitz, Chutoya Gein Aleinu, Binyanenu Shekol Sipurei Ma'asim Asher B'Torah, any story that's found in the Torah, Heim Lahadrichenu B'Derech Yishara Ladat Et Hashem Ula Avdo, is a way of teaching us how to know God and how to fear God and how to serve God. This is a very important yesod in approaching the Torah. The Torah is a book of life. Now, this is a mistake that we make. We think Sefer Bereishis is a book of stories. Oh, let's teach the stories to children and it will interest them. But to a certain degree, we're really doing a disservice. Because then the children, who then grow up to be adults, look at the Chumash as a storybook. Oh, this is what I learned in third grade. Isn't this a nice story? It's not a nice story. I mean, it might be a nice story, but it's much deeper than that. It's the Torah is teaching us through the stories, albeit that the stories must be understood at the level of Pshat, on the simple interpretation, but they also must be understood as allegories for life, as a much deeper meaning as teaching us a lesson. Harold's dream of the thin cows and the fat cows and the thin cheese and the fat cheese, and then he repeats it to Yosef, and then Yosef really repeats it over again as he tells the interpretation. To have one dream repeated three times, there has to be a deeper significance that this dream has to be teaching us. And when we read the Chumash, we have to be alerted to this deeper level and be able to respond and to grow based on this deeper level. So I'd like to try to present today two approaches as perhaps how to understand this story and what lessons we can learn for our lives. The first a bit more philosophical and political, and the second much more practical and rooted in our lives. The first level, which is based on a fantastic insight of the Limudei Nisan, Rav Nissen Alper Zatzal, really a Talmid Mufak of Rav Moshe Zichrono Livracha, like to understand the approach of Rav Alpert based on the ideas of the Rav Zichrono Livracha in an essay, Yonati B'Chagrei Asela. I think this essay, Rabbi Soloveitchik, really gives us a background to understanding what Rav Alpert talks about and is able really to bring it down to a concrete level within our lives. In this particular essay, the Rav deals with a problem that we all confront, whether we're conscious of it or not. And he says the following lies at the root: man is a finite being. He is burdened with finiteness and he is aware of it. He is simply burdened with finiteness awareness, for he himself experiences his finiteness. He does not have to be told that he is a finite, restricted being. He experiences existentially and metaphysically his incompleteness and imperfection, his closeness to nothingness. He knows that his power is restricted, his knowledge nil, his veins ebbing with age, his years are numbered, success is few, frustrations many, and in general his existential prospects are bleak. What a wonderful description of life. But this is basically where we're at. We know this is something that consumes all people. It's called the fear of death. But really not the fear of death as much as the realization that life is so short, how can I accomplish anything in life? When I know that I'm here for such a short time, and none of us know how long our time is here in this world, there's a certain frustration on the finiteness that we encounter, that we're challenged with on an everyday level. And the Rav speaks about, how do we deal with this problem? How do we deal with the fact that we are frightened people, that we are aware that we're here only once on my journey through this world, and I should leave my mark, I should leave my traces, I should accomplish something? How do we deal with this desire to accomplish something with the reality that we're finite? So Rav explains this idea we've mentioned in the past, a powerful idea, that there are two paths that are open to finite man. One is the approach of the society really that we live in. And he says, continuing in the Rav, how does one abandon the moral norm? Simply by intoxication and by drunkenness. He says, not by intoxication by alcohol or drunkenness with whiskey, but by actually intoxicating oneself by the rapturous, hypnotic, hedonistic experience. This overpowers man and takes him out of the world of time, of introspection, anticipation. For hedonistic man, time is reduced to one dimension, the present moment. It results in the loss of rationality. Hedonistic man joins a hedonistic society whose prime objective is to enjoy and not to be overwhelmed either by being or non-being. It is a non-reflective, non-meditating, non-introspective, non-self-appraising or self-searching society. Hedonistic society is more or less a democratic society in pursuit of pleasure and happiness. One approach is if you get so lost in the present moment, if a person can just overwhelm oneself with pleasure, so so then one doesn't need to think about beyond the moment. And if you don't need to think about beyond the moment, and you're so intoxicated by the pleasures of the moment, and you're so caught up, and really eat, drink, and be merry, so okay, tomorrow I'll die, but that's tomorrow. Let me deal with today, let me enjoy today. So this is a society, these are individuals who it's a non-rational approach, who simply try to ignore the reality, try to pretend that the reality doesn't exist, and that's the way they deal with life. And then there's a second group of people. It's the second group of people that's important for us today. The Rav continues, there's another society, because it's another path which human beings take in order to escape from the finite awareness, to engage in illusion and delusion. And this second path, he notes, is the irrational path. While the first was non-rational, this is irrational. And he continues by saying, instead of dimming the I-existence awareness, as hedonistic man does, and surrendering to sensuous rapture of living, man attempts to enhance and exalt his I-awareness. Man traveling through this path is living a big lie. And he explains that a person on this mode of thinking really sets oneself up as a deity, powerful, wise, and creative. The I exist awareness expands to a larger awareness. I exist as creator, as mighty ruler, legislator, and final authority. And this method tries to replace transcendental morality with man-made morality. And as he says, this is a Marxist world outlook. This is the cult of Lenin, of Stalin, of Mao Zedong. They try to overcome human finiteness and imperfection by idolizing themselves. And as a result of this philosophy, he notes, if arrogant man wants to erase his finiteness experience through self-idealization, he must shift his attention from the individual to the society, from the single person to the group to mankind. To idolize the individual is nonsensical. The second approach is to say that we're greater than life. If we're greater than life, then we have the ability, once again, to overcome this finite awareness. This second approach of feeling one is greater than life is really the approach that the Egyptians took in Egypt. Now, if we can appreciate what Rav Alper notes in the Mudeni San, where he says Egypt at that time, we know, was one of the most developed nations in terms of knowledge, of wisdom, of progressiveness and technology, etc. And he says, but they too were bothered by this problem that really we all bothered with from the beginning of time. Bayat ha-netzach matridam emocham. The problem of the finiteness of eternity bothered them. And that's why it explains the Rav. It's not by accident that Egypt was so involved in engraving into stone their history, because they want to be remembered. The Rosetta Stone in the British Museum is something people visit until today. There was this drive that we need to be remembered. We need to be thought about thousands of years from now. So one approach was to engrave things in stone, their history, that people will be able to study about them. And the second is clearly the concept of embalming the people, of mummifying them, in order that they should be around forever. And this was the Egyptians' response to this particular problem. However, as he notes, this concept of making a mummy out of these individuals were only for the elites, for the pharaohs, for the kings, for the rulers, for the upper classes. It was not for the masses. How did they treat the masses? They treated them like they were nothing. The masses were just tools in their hands to do whatever they wanted. They treated them with no respect and really gave them no importance whatsoever. However, it says from the Sinaphore, and its Hebrew is gorgeous, Avaruachi Benosh, however, there's a spirit in mankind, and every man is created in the image of God, and when you try to lower man, you're really lowering the image of God, kivyachol. You're not going to be able to try to suppress the people around you, to idolize yourself, to make yourself into a god, which is what Paro tried to do, and pretend that everyone else just doesn't exist. It's not going to work. And that's how he explains in last week's parasha, when the butler and the baker had the dream, the verse says, Vayihi bayamim ahem, it was at that time, Chatu mashkem el chusrayim, the butler of the king of Egypt sinned, Vahalfe, and the baker, La'adoneim, to their master, L'melech chusrayim, to the king of Egypt. we know, the rabbis tell us that the butler, there was a wine found, fly found in his wine, and there was a pebble found in the bread. Explains Rav Alpert, you notice here that over and over again in this verse, Melech Mitzrayim, the king of Egypt, is used and not Pyro. A king in this reference means that there's a king with a people. When we're talking about the sin of the butler and the baker, on an allegorical level, he's explaining very beautifully that the butler and baker, the fly and the pebble, really reflect the people's relationship to the king. That the people said, if we are dissatisfied, then there's going to be a fly in the wine of the king. If we are treated this way, it's going to be reflected in the fact that there's going to be a pebble in the king's bread. If you're going to be a king of the people and the people are not happy and you're not going to treat the people well, so it's going to have to come out, our unhappiness, our dissatisfaction. And what is Pyro's response? You throw them in jail, you hang them, you do whatever you have to, to quell the rebellion, you don't give them any credibility whatsoever. But continues Rav Alpert, Avaruachi Benos, however, there's a spirit among mankind, Sheino Margio, that does not quiet itself. And in the middle of the night, Pyro has a dream. And now, on the first level, we can understand the dream so well. The dream is about seven thin cows that consume seven fat cows. Seven thin sheaves of wheat that consume seven fat sheaves of wheat. What is this a reference to? Pyro understood it means that the Hamonam, the popular people, are going to consume the elite. He's worried here about a rebellion. He's worried here about all those masses that he's just stepping upon. Perhaps they're going to come up and overthrow his government. And indeed, that's how the Mamiyam Beit HaShoiva of Shvab, Zichrono Livracha, explains this section. And he says, why was there this major town meeting for the entire, you know, wise people after Pyro's dream? Every time Pyro dreamed, he called in an emergency meeting to explain his dreams. Says Rav Schwab, no, he said, Pyro understood that this dream clearly has to do something with the rebellion. If the weak are going to consume the strong, it must be a sign that there's going to be rebellion, there's a coup at hand. And that's why Rav Schwab notes parenthetically, it's not by accident that in most years we read Parshas Mikis during Hanukkah, because the whole theme, one of the themes of Hanukkah, it's Masarta Giborim Biyan Chaloshim V'Rabim Biyan Matim. The strong are in the hands of the weak, and the few are in the hand, the many are in the hands of the few, which is really the theme of Pyro's dream. Now we can continue Rav Alpert, and he says so beautifully. Who's coming to interpret the dream? It's Yosef HaTzadik, an individual who's tasted the other side. An individual who was a servant, who was thrown into prison, he is but a great representation of what it means to be oppressed, to really feel the oppression of the people. And it is to him that Pyro listens to and listens to his advice. What was the advice of Yosef? The advice of Yosef is understood as not just having a person who's going to feed the people, it's much deeper than that. The advice of Yosef, as Rav Alpert points out, is a mapecha harishona ba'olam. It's one of the first political changes that happens in the world. What Yosef is really saying is that the kingdom has to support the people. It's not a question that the person isn't a tool in the hands of the king, but rather the king has to be sensitive to the people's needs, and the king is responsible to feed the people. The king is responsible for the welfare of the people. This was an outlook. And until today, as Rav Alpert concludes this essay, there are some nations that have taken the lesson of Yosef. Until today, there are some nations that still have not learned the lesson, and they treat the regular people as dirt, as nothing, as tools in their hands, without appreciating Avaruachi Benosh, there is a spirit among people. And as Rav Alpert says so beautifully, this is really a model for us in relationship with God, that God cares about the small people, the regular people. God cares about each and every individual in this world. What Yosef HaTzadik is saying is by paying attention to the small, it's really Matatio Deo of paying attention to every individual's found here. And Rav Alper concludes this essay that the only way you're going to fight the problem of Netzach, of eternity, and this self-limited time we're in this world, is Et Elokim Yeru, through the fear of God. This latter idea that I'd like to develop, just to round out the first level, once again in Yonati B'Chagvei Sela, in the writings of Rav Soloveitchik. He says, how does Judaism respond to this same question? And he says that Judaism asserts that the eye awareness can never be cast off, suppressed, or changed by man. Man must abandon the hedonism as a big lie. He must reconcile with the finiteness awareness and abolish all traces of spiritual gluttony. That's not our path. Man cannot and must not attempt to suspend the finite awareness for the latter's intrusion to the texture of the eye experience. Hence, man alone is unable to free himself of all the symptoms that awareness, such as feeling of loneliness, boredom, and frustration, anguish, or fear. Salvation of man can only come from God. His compassion will heal man from the anxiety of being incomplete, finite, and transient. Certainly not fear of death nor death itself can ever be eliminated by man. And to a certain degree, and this is a very powerful idea, God has built into the system this feeling, this fear, this anxiety. And it's because it's built into the system that forces man, really is an impetus for man, to form a relationship with God, to form closeness to God. Because if you recognize that our lives are so, so dependent on God, and we don't know what tomorrow will bring, and we don't know what the future will bring, that means that we must turn, like a child who turns to a parent and holds their hand in fear of what will the unknown bring. The monsters of the night that the child embraces the parent, the nightmares of the night, that's how we have to turn to God and to embrace Him. That's the Rav describes as the Mimamakim experience, the experience of the depth of clinging to God and holding on to Him really for dear life. And that's why the Rav explains that man's insecurity lies at the very root of prayer. Without man's insecurity, there would be no prayer. The latter's response to human insecurity. The act of praying is a religious response to need, to the experience of distress, existential straits, and narrowness when man feels pressed and defeated. That's what life is all about. That's the Jewish response, is to turn to God. But the Rav concludes this essay with an idea we've done a number of times in the past, that prayer in Judaism is not just a recital. One must need to translate prayer into our daily life, into our being. And that's how the Rav describes that to live a prayerful life means to live a life dedicated to God and dedicated to understanding that we as individuals have a mission to do in this world. That we're not cast in the world in vain, that we're not just a number somewhere, but rather we each have an assignment, and our lives as individuals is to play our role out, to play it out completely, to recognize that God put us here for a purpose. As He says so beautifully, each Jew is the herald, the harbinger of the Melech HaMashiach. Each Jew is a Melech HaMashiach in miniature, because he blazes the trail for the great Melech HaMashiach, because each Jew has a messianic assignment. So Rav explains that we're here in order to do our assignment, and once we've done it, we walk off the stage. The moment he finishes his job, the lights are dimmed, or rather extinguished, and we do not wait for the applause. This is what life is about, that we have meaning, we have purpose, and however long we are here, we recognize that we have a job to do. And I think that this is the key idea on the first level of what the dreams represent. In Paro's dream, in Paro's mind, you deify the great. You put them into, make them into mummies that they'll be around forever. And in this way, you try to overcome the finite experience. If you pay no attention to the masses. Yosef's response is, no, the masses are what counts. Your job is here to serve the masses. Because every single individual, of Aruach Ibenosh, there's a spirit among mankind. Every single individual is here to serve God. Every single individual is here to have a relationship with God, a messianic assignment, and that each one of us
has that relationship where we turn to God in need, that we recognize our special importance.
This idea that we're all here for a purpose, we all here have something special to do, does not mean, as a final point before moving on to second level, that there are not some people who are greater than others. Yes, there are people who are put here in this world who are great people, and some people who are not great people. But that's not the defining mark on how we look at people. This is a very important insight of Moshe Feinstein Zatzal in Drash Moshe, where he speaks about on the Pasuk, Hu Aaron Moshe, who took the Jews out of Egypt, and Rashi says, why did it sometimes say Aaron and Moshe, and sometimes Moshe and Aaron? To teach you, Shishkulim Kechad, they're equal as one. Ask for Moshe, you're equal as one. Hayitachein, is this possible? Moshe Rabbeinu, no one ever came up who was as great as Moshe, Navi as great as Moshe. He's equal to Aaron and K&P. So the first answer Moshe gives is they were equal in terms of both being sent on a mission by God to take the Jews out. But the second answer, which is, I think, a very profound one for our discussion today, is that they were equal in terms of that both were able to do their mission with the same Mesiras Nefesh, with the same amount of passion, of dedication to who they were. Yes, Moshe Rabbeinu was greater, but Moshe Rabbeinu was able in his greatness to fulfill his entire potential of greatness. And Aaron, on the level that he was created, was able to fulfill his entire potential to be the Aaron. In life, you have people who are given a tremendous amount of greatness, of inner potential. And there's some people who have a limited IQ, who have limited abilities, and who have limited amount of what they can accomplish. And that's the way God made the world, that not everyone is created equal. That's reality. There's some people with greater potential than others. But that's irrelevant, because what's relevant is how much energy do you put in to do that which you need to do. So if a person is able to put in 30%, and that's all he can put in, and 30% for him is 100, and he puts in 20%, he is much greater than a person who's able to accomplish 100% and does 40%. You can't compare. So yes, 40% is more than 28%, but who cares? 40 compared to 100, 28 compared to 30, clearly the person who had less ability is greater because he fulfilled a greater potential. And this is the key way of us viewing the world. We don't look at people, this one's greater than that one, but rather how much potential has one accomplished in this world. And it's a mirror reflecting back on ourselves. We say, oh, look how wonderful we are, look how much we've accomplished. You know, it's time to just sit back, relax. You can't relax. If you've accomplished a lot, that means you have a lot more to accomplish. That means you have a tremendous amount. If you're able to do all this by 35, can you imagine what you can do by 70? Can you imagine what you can do by 100? There's so much that's within you to constantly continue forward. That's level one. The second level is based on the insights of the Manchester Rav Zichrono Livracha in Inspiration and Insight. He notes in his essay on Parshas Miketz that no less than 5 times does Yosef underscore to the heathen king that it was from God. Over and over again, Yosef answered Paro saying, that is beyond me, it's Elohim who responds with Paro's welfare, etc. They said we would expect that such talk be directed to someone who possessed some degree of heavenly awe, or who could at least be inclined towards such awe. It would seem, though, that invoking the name of God when speaking to Paro would achieve little, if anything. Egypt was a place steeped in idol worship and immorality, and all the greatness that Paro was later to see in Yosef, his father and brothers, would not sway the king from his heathen doctrines. Would it not have sufficed for Yosef to say once that the dreams and its interpretations were divinely ordained? What did Yosef hope to accomplish in speaking of Hashem again and again? So here, says the Manchester Rav, and this is our second level, it's a message directed not at Paro, but at ourselves. Yosef's frequent mention of God as the source of the dream and what it foretold conveys the timelessness of his words. For situation, solution is divinely ordained, serves as a lesson for all time. Manchester Rubs brings 3 arenas. I'd like to bring 2, where you see this, how it relates to our lives. And he really speaks about that the 7 years of plenty represent 7 years of concept of opportunity, and famine means where the opportunity is lost, and how the two need to interrelate one with each other. On the first level, he speaks about how the Mesillas Yesharim, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, points out in his first chapter that our sages of blessed memory have taught us that man was created solely to delight in closeness to God and to derive pleasure from the splendor of his presence. The place where this pleasure may be derived is actually the world to come. However, the pathway to reach this place of our desire is this world. And that we do this through the mitzvos. A famous story of the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, who right before he died held his tzitzis and began crying, and he says, through observing the mitzvah of tzitzis, one can merit to bask in the glory of the Shechina, of the Divine Presence. In this world, the mitzvah of tzitzis can be obtained for a little bit of money. In the next world, it cannot be obtained at all. There's no end to accumulating mitzvahs. And this is the point of our Paro's dream on the first level. Our days in this world are Yemei Asova, the days of abundance, when one has unlimited opportunity to gather and store abundant merits for the days of famine. Of the future, when this opportunity will be no more. Every Jew should emulate Yosef by being a discerning and wise person and make the most of the precious years that he's allotted on this earth. On the first level, the days of sova, of plenty, are our lives. For nothing we can pick up a mitzvah. Once we get to the next world, it's too late. That's why the Gra was crying. This is the time to do all that we can do and invest in the future. And here the Yaakov Lekach Tov quotes Rav Elia Lopian Zatzal, who asks a very obvious question. He says, why is it necessary for Yosef to say you need a wise person to gather the food? Would we not have thought you need an orderly person, an organized person? Why a wise person? So he says, very appropriately, he says, human nature is when you see a lot of food around you, so you don't think about what's going to be after that. You just think about the moment. And therefore, a person is not going to really save up for the future. A wise person, it's a chacham, is haroe et hanolad. The wise person is one who sees the future. It doesn't say in Mishnah Pirkei Avos, yodea et hanolad, knows the future, but rather to see the future. You have to have the ability to put the future in front of your eyes at all times, and then to be able to act appropriately in this world. Yosef was an individual who was able to understand, to see in front of him what famine must be like, and thereby be able to store up appropriately for the famine in the times of sova, in the times of plenty. And that's each and every one of us. This is the allegory for life. Haroa tanola, that's a chacham. To be able to see that the world isn't going to live forever. As we spoke about at the beginning of this year, our days are numbered here. We need to take that which we have and be able to utilize it the best now before it becomes too late, before we reach the level of Rav, the level of the famine. There's a wonderful mashal that Yaakov Lekach Tov brings, a very famous mashal of an individual who the king wanted to reward for doing something very special. And he told the individual, you have an hour in my royal treasuries, and whatever you can take in an hour is yours. So the man is really excited. He brings in barrels and barrels into the royal treasury, and the clock ticks 9 o'clock, and the king says, okay, you have 1 hour, go for it. And as he's about to put his hand into these beautiful rubies and diamonds and jewels, the king had put in there a violinist, a beautiful, beautiful music. And the violinist begins to play. And the man says, oh, this is such beautiful music. Let me stand for a minute and enjoy it. I have an hour. I have plenty of time. And he enjoys it. And as he's about to go back to what, collecting the diamonds, the violinist changed the tune. He says, oh, let me just listen to this piece of music. I have plenty of time. And this is what happened for the whole hour. When the clock struck 10, he had but a couple of diamonds that he was able to put in his pocket the last minute. And all of his barrels are empty. And this is such an apropos mashal to our lives, where we come into this world and for nothing we're able to put our hands into the basket
and take out diamonds. Mitzvos come by us so easily. And what do we say? The Yetzirah is so strong. You have time to do the mitzvah. You have years on this world. You'll get to it. You'll get to it. Not now. You'll get to it. The Mashal teaches us that we don't have forever. The clock is going to tick. When you have a mitzvah that you can do, somebody needs help, somebody needs something, you have the opportunity to do something, you grab the mitzvah, you grab the opportunity, you're able to put your hand in and take out as much diamonds as possible. The second level, which is a little bit more specific for our lives, that the Manchester Rav brings, is we know the Rambam in Hilchos Brachos and the Laws of Blessing writes, it's a positive Torah commandment to recite a blessing after eating a meal. And the sages decree that one should recite a blessing over every food and only then partake of it. And we know that blessings can be divided into three categories: blessings of pleasure, blessings of mitzvot, and blessings of praise and thanksgiving and supplication, so that one be ever cognizant of his Creator and be fearful of him. And the concept of blessings, the concept of saying 100 blessings each day, is to bring God consciousness into our lives. Continues the Manchester Rav and notes, through the course of a day, and this is either a day literally of 24 hours, it's related also to the course of months, to the course of years as well, one often comes upon moments of famine, when his spiritual strength is strained, and he is in need of chizuk, of spiritual support, to overcome the trials of the hour. How one has utilized his moments of abundance will spell the difference between success or failure during rough times. For it is the moments of sova, of plenty, that must fuel those of rav, of hunger. As we have seen, the daily recitation of 100 blessings is meant to instill in us awe of God, and as the Maimonides note, should cause us to be ever cognizant of him. And likewise, the three davenings are prime sources of daily spiritual sustenance. In fact, the Kuzari compares the tefillos to three daily meals, in the same way that each meal provides a person with necessary nourishment to sustain him until the next meal. And clearly this is related, particularly with regard to Kavanah, to the proper concentration in davening. But I think the second idea is likewise very powerful. Life is about moments when you have a tremendous amount of spiritual strength, and moments and years and months where the strength wanes. And one must take from those strong spiritual moments to store it up within us, to really be able to take it in, to be able to help us in the times of difficulty. Once again, the mashal, the parable, the Yalkut Lechal Tov, uses if a person is caught in a very dark place, and we've all been in situations like this, very dark street, we're driving, we get lost, you're in a pea soup fog, and you just can't see ahead of you. And suddenly there's a flash of lightning above, or some light goes on, a headlight of a car, you know, coming the opposite direction. And suddenly you're able to see so clearly the path ahead of you. Know exactly where you are, what street you're on, where you have to go. There are two ways to react to this light, to this bolt of lightning, to this headlights of the car. You can either say, wow, I have light, I feel so much better right now. Or you could say, now that I have the light, how am I going to track my course the next couple of minutes? And that's the difference. When we have times of plenty, do we just bask in the time of plenty? Are we able to say, how can I then utilize this time of plenty when it's become dark again and I'm going to need it to be able to move forward? One key prerequisite in order to be able to use the times of plenty for the times of need is found hinted at within the analysis of these dreams as well. And that's in a comment that the Lubavitcher Rebbe makes, that Rabbi Sachs brings down in the book Torah Studies. He says it's very interesting to compare the dreams of Yosef in last week's parasha, of where they're binding the sheaves in the middle of the field, and his sheaf rises, remains standing, and the sheaves gathered around and bow down to his sheaf. And the dream of the sun, the star, and the moon's bowing down to him was that of Paros. And he notes two major differences. Firstly, Yosef's dreams begin with an image of service, of bread earned by labor. We were binding the sheaves, which this idea is wholly absent from the dreams of Paro. Food is seen as coming without any effort. And the second is Yosef's dreams represent the progression from lower to higher forms of perfection, individual ears to sheaves, while Paro's dreams the order is reversed, from cows we go to wheat, and from the animal to the vegetable, and from the fat to the skinny. It's interesting, parenthetically, the Bar Moshe points out that you have all the components in Paro's dream. You have the domain, the inanimate, you have the tzomeach, the vegetative world, you have the chai, you have the world of the animals, but you don't have the medaber, you don't have the world of speaking. There's a key element which is missing in Paro's dream that Yosef's dream has. What do we learn from all this? So says the Rebbe, from all this we can learn a specific lesson. When a person believes that he can receive benefits or blessing without effort, merely as a result of certain natural causes, he can be sure this belief derives from his animal soul, the unspiritual side of his nature. For at this level, there can indeed be benefit without effort. But he must equally be aware that things of this realm are continually in a state of decline. He will, in the end, be left with nothing. Were he, on the other hand, to labor in the service of God, he'd be assured of the promise you have toiled and you have found. The prerequisite in order to make the spiritual times be successful in the times of when things are more difficult, one key component is being able to expend effort in the times of the spiritual times. If we take the spiritual times for granted and we don't work at it and we don't try to assimilate into who we are, if we're not binding those sheaves, if we're not actually becoming involved and working it through and really engaging in the process, we sort of speak, you know, yeah, we daven and we take it for granted, we daven, we say blessings, we have spiritual experiences, but we don't try to make it part of ourselves, so it's not going to be able to last, it's not going to be able to hold a person, you're at a point of decline, like Paro's dream is a point downward, where bread comes out of nowhere, there is no effort. The key in life to be successful, the key in life to grow, is to expend effort. And this idea is mirrored an idea we saw last week, just like to develop it a little bit differently once again this week in the Shemi Shmuel. We know that Paro changes Yosef's name to Safna Paneach, and yet the Torah points out that Yosef emerged in charge of the land of Egypt. Yosef was 30 years. Yosef left Paro's presence, and as Menachem Sion points out, that he's never referred to as Safna Paneach, but as Yosef. He maintains his idea constantly, and he's called throughout the Chumash, even by the Egyptians, as Yosef. What's the significance of this? So Menachem Sion points out significance is that it was one of the hallmarks of the Jews, that they never changed their name. They were able to maintain their identity. The Shemi Shmuel, on a little bit of a deeper conceptual level, says the concept of Yosef is the crucial concept that we need to learn for our lives. And he speaks about the verse we mentioned last week in our Chanukah Shir of Chanoch Lanao Pidarko Gam Ki Yaskin Lo Yasur Mimena, that one must train a child when they're young, so when they're old they never leave this as well. It explains to Shemi Shmuel, Sekhet Sheva Rebbe, leave what? Shelo Yasir Minyan HaChinuch. They never leave the aspects of growing, of rededicating and reeducating oneself. The key in life is to always look at oneself as growing, as constantly renewing and rejuvenating oneself. And that's the concept of Hanukkah, of a Hillel saying, you're Mosif HaHolech, you always add a candle. Because life is always about this rejuvenation, this moving upward. And that's why Hanukkah always falls out in the Parshios of Yosef. Because what is the Midah of Yosef? It's his name. Yosef Hashem Li Ben Acher. God should give me another son. The concept of wanting more, of growing, of constantly developing, of moving forward. This is the concept that when Yaakov hears that Yosef is alive, he says, Rav Ol Yosef Beni Chai, my son is still alive. Yosef is always on the level of Chai, on the level of newness. This is the aspect of being successful in taking our spiritual journeys and making us successful in life. Expending effort, part and parcel of expending effort, is a focus on Yosef. Yosef never loses his name. The whole key of the parshios of what Yosef represents is you constantly have to say to yourself, okay, I daven today, but my davening today is different because I'm a different person. who I am today is not who I was yesterday. And I have to invest in my davening today. That's a different aspect. I've learned different things. I've been exposed to different things. My relationship to God, my dependence on God is different. When you hear about, you know, God forbid, a car accident when a young person dies, so you recognize how you're so dependent on God. And when you dive in the next davening, you're going to expend more effort on how we recognize that our every single moment, our lives, our lives are given over to God's hands. That effort, that rejuvenation makes us a person who's constantly growing, who's constantly able to take from the times of plenty for the times when things are more difficult. And therefore, in conclusion, we saw that Paro's dream on the first level is symbolic of the arrogant society, which is a response to the eye awareness, dissatisfaction among the masses. The dreams are the masses consuming the elite. The solution, at Yosef's solution, the elite must benefit the masses. And the prayer for life is dedicated to our missions of Aruach Ibenos, mankind has a spirit within them. Pharaoh's dream on the second level is preparation from time of plenty to times of famine. This world in regard to the next world, where we have to have constant awareness of our lives, the mashal of the king and the violin and the jewels. We have to take the moments of our lives for moments that are more difficult. Life needs effort expended. It's the model of the dark road where you need to take that lightning and be able to put it further. And Yosef is really our model of these parshios. It's the constant renewal, the constant growth, never reaching a level of apathy. But gam ki yaskin lo yasur menu, even as we get old, we never leave chinuch, we never leave dedication, we never leave looking at ourselves as how can we grow, how can we rejuvenate ourselves, and how can we always work on a process of being dependent on God as a new person each and every day in our relationship with God.